All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for being here tonight. For those who don't know me, I'm Cheryl Snyder. I head up the arts and culture programming at KTOO, and I'm also on the board of directors for the Juno Arts and Humanities Council. It's our two organizations that teamed up to bring Modest here for the big show tomorrow night. And I just want to thank all of you because you're here as supporters of public media. So yay, you. Thank you. And I also just want to let you know how very special this gathering is. Modest is doing this completely on his own time. He's got a very full schedule. He did a show last night. He traveled most of today. He's doing the show tomorrow night, and then he's on a plane first thing Saturday morning to go off to the next thing. So he just volunteered to do this on his own tonight, which is just totally awesome. So what you can expect, this is an opportunity for you to have a conversation with him. Be prepared to ask some of your good questions. And we are recording this. We're going to air this tomorrow on a Juno afternoon, and we'll also post the audio on our website. So without much further ado, please give a hearty welcome and thank you to Modest Yahoo.
Hi, I'm asking this on behalf of a friend of mine. He's a Jersey kid turned farmer.
Farmer?
In Palmer, Alaska.
Good for him.
Yeah, and he really wishes he could be here tonight. Mm. But Palmer's kind of far away. And I asked him what he would ask you if he was here. And he said, so ask Modest if God was sitting in the front row at one of his shows, which one of his songs would he dedicate to God?
Ooh. Let's see. There's four.
I'm not trying to be blasphemous, by the way.
Which one of you is God? Yeah, all right. I really, all my songs are kind of, I don't have one song in when I'm playing music, so I sort of treat the whole experience as a spiritual event. To me, it's sort of like there was a story in the Torah of the high priest that he used to walk into the Holy of Holies, into the inner sanctuary to pray on behalf of the community. And they had to tie a rope around his ankle because if he wasn't pure, he would die. And they'd have to drag him out by a rope. It's a little dark. But my humor's a little dry, so just bear with me. And that's how I recently have started to feel like the shows to me is the music is really a holy thing, and I treat it that way. The whole thing for me, the whole show for me is like a conversation with God. I mean, I'm not always thinking about God, but I do sort of feel that music is super holy and has the power to really transform people and take people on a journey into themselves and expand their consciousness. And so, you know, when I'm performing music, that's kind of my goal is always to try to have that kind of experience. And I feel that there's times when the music, you know, we improvise a lot, and when the music gets to a certain place where I'll start praying in Hebrew, because that's the language that I learned how to pray in, and I'll feel like I'm really talking to God or really expressing sort of the deepest kind of elements or aspects of my inner being to God in front of the people, you know. And I'll try to, I'm sort of like bringing people into that very intimate experience. And for me, I sort of feel like then if I feel like connected or like it's really happening, like it's working, I get like elated. I feel like really good about who I am and what I do. And when it doesn't happen, I feel like you gotta pull me out by a string. Like I feel like swallowed up by the whole situation. I get sort of overwhelmed. And when I'm in those moments and the music kind of opens up and it can go in any direction, I just start pulling lyrics from all the different songs that I've written. So, and in those moments, like everything, I become aware that all my songs are really about the same thing and they're interchangeable. The words, the lyrics, you can, you know, there's certain themes, but they all kind of relate to each other. There's it's not out of context if I pull songs from words from one song to another song and then say some lyrics from like another artist that inspired me and then pull words from the Torah or the prayers, the Psalms. It all kind of blends together into one thing. That's not really that direct of an answer, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks.
So we have some students from the university here tonight, and my question for you would be, what would you recommend young people who are really interested in pursuing music as a passion or even as a part of their career? What opportunities should they pursue at this stage in their life?
If they're musicians specifically? I think the most important thing is really just to listen to music and just connect with what you love and then spend time just developing your craft, whatever it is that you do. I think it all comes from the inside out. A lot of people are chasing success, but I feel that when you really have something to say, and that comes from just living your life with as few crutches as possible, just experiencing the reality as it hits you, and then listening to music, the music you love, and figuring out your own voice and your own craft and how to focus on that. And then, just develop that. And then if you're going to be sick, you know, if you have what to give, then I think the universe kind of makes it happen for you. Mm-hmm.
Thanks very much. Do you mind talking a little bit about your creative process?
No, I don't mind. Live music or recording music or?
Whatever you're comfortable with. I'm more interested in the live performances myself.
Okay. When I come out on stage, I kind of am who I am, and you kind of get what you get. Like, you know, I don't really, I'm sober now at this point in my life, and a lot of artists would drink or get high before a show to get the inspiration that they need, and I don't really have that going on in my life. So I tend to be a little moody and down sometimes, and I come out on stage where I am, and if I try to pretend that I'm not that, and I get into thinking like people paid money to see this charismatic guy and I'm supposed to be something other than I am, I get depressed on stage, and that doesn't go well. So I just I come out where I'm at. I don't write a set list. I feel kind of what I look down. I have like a list of songs, or else I'll forget. I might have a list with like 50 songs on it, and I look at it right before the set, and then I come out on stage, and I just sort of, the one that calls my name, we start playing, and then we improvise. We do like, you know, the verse, chorus, and then we just open up and just see what happens with the music. And it you know, requires a lot of listening and paying attention. And over the course of a tour, we'll sort of develop a certain sound. There'll be like certain songs that we might play more often or certain moves that we might make. But I'm always more interested in sort of not doing the thing that I know will get a reaction or that will be like good, but actually holding back from doing that and seeing what new can happen. And that's sort of a risk because sometimes, you know, the songs might just go into nowhere and nothing happens. But if I keep trying that throughout the course of a show, at some point there's some kind of like, something like breaks open. And And then I'm actually able to like have a really unique experience with the people that are there and the energy of that place and what's going on with me and with the musicians. And then I actually go through like a transformation where I kind of, my emotional state comes up, and then I feel very much like I can interact with people from a very real place. And then I'll sing songs like Jerusalem or One Day or Sunshine that are more happy songs, but I'll actually feel happy when I'm singing them. And then there's a back and forth between like me and the audience. But the show for me is all about dynamics and about taking people into different places, taking them into like different rooms of a house kind of, and creating that with the lights and with the music. So that's kind of where that process is. Mm-hmm.
I've been thinking about how to formulate this question, and well, speaking of being depressed, a lot of us can get depressed right now if we think about racial upheaval, the presidential election, climate change, et cetera, et cetera. But a lot of us had this moment of, or I sensed a moment of transition this morning, exactly at the autumnal equinox, when this incredible sunrise came out, and we also had a rainbow at the same time. And there was this feeling, there was a shift in the air. How do you sense, or do you feel that your music or what you do, your mission in life plays into what could be a real pivotal transition for all of us right now?
Well, I try not to think too cosmically or too big, because I sort of did that for a little while with my religion and with certain psychedelic drugs, you know, and I've really tried to just focus on what's right in front of me and not get too caught up with feeling like I'm changing the world with my music, but just feel like maybe I can just make a slight shift in my own self and with the people that are in the room.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you for the reminder of right in front of you.
Just out of curiosity, aside from your music, what's something you may have shared this with other audiences before, or something that people may not know about you that's maybe fun or quirky or just genuinely human? I think sometimes people look for something.
We're talking food.
I don't know. You do an interesting hobby that really like, oh, Modest Yahoo does that?
Well, this is kind of cool. My dad retired this year. And I hired him as my tour manager, and he's here right now. So we've been working really close together. And we ride motorcycles, Harley Davidsons. Yep.
Hello. What's the first inspiration that like made you become the musician or who you are?
I'm not sure the first, but I definitely like probably the biggest impact I had was when I was 16 on LSD in Worcester, Massachusetts at a Phish concert. And that just blew my whole entire existence open as to what music could be, you know, and how it affected my world. So if I had to choose like one, as much as I hate to, promote or glorify drugs, especially with kids in the room, I have a hard time like not being honest. And that was probably like the most impactful moment when it came to music and me deciding that that's what I wanted to do.
So one of my defining moments of music was when I first heard your Live at Stubbs CD. And actually my favorite song is off that. It's Beatbox. Was that something that was pre-planned, or was that something that just kind of happened? Because a 5-minute beatbox solo is not conventional fare.
Oh, get ready for tomorrow, dude. Because it's just me and guitar. So it's like I did 20 minutes in a row of beatboxing last night. When I'm playing with guitar, when it's a duo acoustic thing, I sort of especially when my voice is heavy like it is now because I've been traveling a lot, I spend a lot of time during the show beatboxing. So hopefully you have a ticket for tomorrow. You look kind of sad like you don't. On Live at Stubbs, I think I was planning to beatbox. I don't remember exactly, but the beatbox itself was improvised. That wasn't like written out or anything like that.
So I had the opportunity to see you about 12 years ago in central Minnesota. And I found it absolutely fantastic, even that you clearly dress differently and you look a little more relaxed today than you did 12 years ago. But I was amazed at the juxtaposition between what was coming out of your mouth, particularly during your beatbox sessions, and the way you presented yourself physically. Have you found a better balance in your life?
Yeah, that's been sort of the name of the game for me, is focusing on trying to be more balanced and less extreme. It's a little bit in my nature to be extreme. And I've tried to walk the middle road more and more, and I feel like I've been somewhat successful at that. Mm-hmm.
It was a great show, by the way.
Thank you.
And you opened for a band named Wookiefoot.
Oh, yeah. Remember them. I'm like 12 years ago, it was probably opening up for Wookiefoot.
Do you have any like tips for like, I'm a beatboxer and singer, and like, do you have any tips like at all?
I think where I really developed it was there was a summer I lived in Oregon actually, and I came home for the summer and I worked at a bookshop and I saved up money and I bought a PA. Sort of like this, maybe a little bit bigger, like four times the size. And with some effects processors, and I had a drum set. And I just spent a lot of time, my dad probably remembers, in the attic, banging on the drums with a mic and a stand, and just singing with delays and beatboxing into like a microphone with effects. And I really sort of learned a lot about music that way, and about rhythm, space, and time, and melody. And because of the microphone, you know, you're able to do certain things and pick up and hear certain things that you wouldn't be able to, and then you're able to develop those things. And then the next thing for me was doing it with a band, because then it can really become like an instrument, and you can be collaborative with other people. And a lot of times a beatboxer, if you have a drummer playing drums, there's no real place for the beatbox because the drums are usually a lot louder and you're doing the same thing. You might be stepping on each other's toes. So if you can find like a guitar player or a piano player or something like that and play with them through a PA while they're playing, it becomes like a lot more musical when you're working with other musicians doing it.
Do you know how to beatbox? Can you show us?
Maybe in the end I'll beatbox for a minute for you.
Okay.
All right.
I have two questions, but maybe I'll just ask one and I'll try to spread it out.
Okay.
Someone recently told me after I threw this party, she texted me later and she said, "Thanks, that was everything I didn't know I needed." And that line has just been following me around a lot lately. And I'm just wondering, for you, what's something that happened to you recently that was everything you didn't know you needed?
I might have to think about that like overnight and get back to you tomorrow. I don't know.
I got time.
Let me see if anything pops into my head here, everything I didn't know. You think of anything? Nothing's coming to my mind. I'm sorry.
You want my other question?
Sure, might as well, yeah.
Do you collect anything?
No, I don't think so. I don't really collect anything. Now, I mean, people give me a lot of like stones and crystals and stuff, but it kind of freaks me out a little bit. So I usually leave them places, you know. On tour, I get a lot of stuff from fans, which is really cool because I usually travel in the bus and I have this little back room in the bus that I live in and sleep in, listen to music in, do everything in this little room that's like maybe, yeah, about half the size of this stage probably, like about as wide and half the size. And that's my quarters for like 3-4 months at a time. I get out of there. I mean, I go on stage, I take walks and stuff, but I find myself back there a lot and it becomes like my little sanctuary. And when I start out on a tour, it's like, you know, just bare. I mean, there's the windows, look out the windows and stuff when we're driving and when we're parked. But I get stuff from fans, like kids a lot of times will write little, you know, cards and paintings and pictures. People give me necklaces that they made. Someone made me a quilt, and that quilt is like the blanket that I bring. I'm like a baby. I bring this blanket everywhere with me. Not everywhere, but on tour I have it. So, yeah, so the room starts to become filled with stuff, you know, and then when I feel down sometimes, I look at, like, some card that a kid made me that says, like, Mauricio, we love you, you know, and it makes me feel better. You know, different colors and stuff like that. So I guess, yeah, I do collect that kind of stuff. And then I throw it away at the end of the tour. Broken cars. Yeah, I got some old broken cars. Dad's not happy about that. Do they sit in his driveway when I'm not home? Yep.
Who's next?
I've been playing music in front of people since I was 17 or 18 years old. So I'm 37 right now. Do the math. That's like 20 years. Yeah.
A short stop here before Kobe, then you can go. I was wondering, I had a different question at first, but then talking about kids, you just reminded me that you're a dad. And I was just wondering about, as a dad and a musician, and, you know, what's your kind of your sense of your children and how this works for you as a dad to be an artist and this type of art you're doing?
Well, it's cool because I go away for work and then I come home. And I have a lot of time with them. I take them to school in the morning. I pick them up in the afternoon. I take them to soccer practice and hockey practice and make lunches and do laundry. And I'm like full-time dad when I'm home. My boys live with me. And then I go away, you know. And I've been doing that since they were born. So they're sort of used to it, and I'm sort of used to it. And it, like my 5-year-old right now, it's a little bit hard for him. When I leave, I see he gets a little upset. But I think kids get over it pretty quickly. Like, he's with mom and he's in his life. And I think probably within a matter of like a day or so, he's used to his other life. And then it's always exciting. I get to see them like every, whatever it is, whenever I come back from tour, it's like, it's awesome. And then I get to be with them. And those are the two greatest things in my life, you know, and my kids being a dad and music, you know, being able to make music. And, what else? And then they come with me on tour a lot, you know, like my 5-year-old isn't really, he's in school, but you know, the older ones can't really miss school. They were with me this summer on tour 3 times, you know, for like a week each time. And my 5-year-old last year was with me on a tour for almost a month, you know, just me and him. He'd fall asleep on stage, you know, every night, like literally in front of the guitar amp or on the drum riser. And, it's just fun to have a little dude around. We watch Nacho Libre all the time on the tour bus. He can recite the whole movie. Yeah, so we have fun. Thank you.
That reminds me a little bit of the like the fisherman's lifestyle here in Alaska, you know, where they're off for a number of weeks or months at a time. So I didn't know that. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi.
Hey.
So my question is, how do you deal with the amount of stress, or, I mean, if you get it, but the stress before a show or an interview or something?
I don't usually get stressed before interviews. Before shows, sometimes I do, like if it's really cold outside. Like last night, I played an outdoor show in the town where my daughter lives and that I used to started making music in, and I noticed right before the show I was really shaky. I couldn't tell if it was because I was cold or I was nervous. But I just try to focus on the music. I just don't really let it get to me too much. I try to start playing as soon as possible so I don't have to sit around and be nervous for too long. And then I just get into the music and try and be good at what I do. But yeah, I don't usually get nervous before shows. I've been doing it now for so long that it's kind of second nature.
Thank you.
I get stressed out about other things, though.
Yeah.
How did you get, like, noticed or able to perform in front of people?
Well, it was pretty noticeable, this Hasidic guy singing reggae music. And wasn't too typical, so it was easy for me to get noticed. I was into music, and then I went home to New York, and I went to college, and I became religious. And I started dressing the part as well, with the hat and the suit and the beard, the yarmulke, and I moved to Crown Heights, which is a neighborhood in Brooklyn. And I studied all day long in yeshiva, Torah. And I had a friend, a rabbi, who had a synagogue in the village in Manhattan. And I used to go see him sometimes, and sometimes we would be up on Friday nights drinking vodka late at night, and I would start rapping and beatboxing and stuff. And so he kind of knew I did it, and he was doing menorah lighting on Hanukkah in the what's called in Union Square, which is like a real busy place down in the village. And set up a huge PA system. And I brought some musicians from Crown Heights. There's like a homeless guy that played keyboards in the synagogue out front. I brought him and a kid who played the drum set. And this ragtag group of guys on the subway with our instruments. And we went to Union Square and we set everything up. And during the menorah lighting, he was kind of loud guy. He was yelling at people or just speaking loudly about Hanukkah. I think he was on a ladder. It was like a huge menorah, like obnoxiously big. And then we started playing, and I was beatboxing and singing and doing what I do. And I had my eyes closed. A lot of times I close my eyes because I get distracted by things easily. So, and then when I opened my eyes, there was literally like hundreds of people and a video camera there. And like I think it was within weeks I was asked to come to perform on a CNN thing because it was interesting to people, and then everything kind of happened real quick for me. So it helped being Hasidic.
How does your connection, passion, and/or relationship with God affect your performances?
Connection, passion, and relationship affect? Well, sort of in the way I was talking about when I first came in, you know? You know, I guess for me, like at the times in my life when I felt like the most down, music played like the biggest role for me in terms of like where I would turn to. Music and prayer, because I always, even since I was a teenager at least, believed in God. And so when I felt like I was really struggling and I didn't have anywhere to turn and I was like losing myself and I didn't know what to do next, I either like put on music or I would like go take a walk and pray, like talk to God. And then basically I found like music that combines it, like, you know, Bob Marley, and that music sort of had a lot of like, it's felt like prayer to me, like the words came from the Old Testament and, you know, he spoke a lot about God and felt like, it felt like when I watched him, like he felt like he had a personal connection with God. So I started, I actually heard someone in a park singing the Rastaman chant, which is comes from the Psalms of David. And I was like, I put it all together. I was like, oh, those Psalms are connected with me and my heritage as a Jew. Those were words written by King David. And, you know, the words really resonated with me. And it was like a prayer. So I started basically singing or praying to God in the music, through music. And that's kind of what I do. That's to this day. There's not much outside it. For me, that's what it is. It's like therapy. It's like a way to reach out to something beyond myself when I feel I'm not able to have the answers, or when I feel I don't have, when I'm down, basically. Cool, thank you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, just wondering, years from now, or maybe hundreds of years from now, when you stop and you look back at everything you've done, whether being a dad, playing music, is there anything that comes to mind that you hope people remember you by, you know, like?
I guess I just like, you know, just that people can turn my song on or my music, or had some kind of experience at a show that helped them in their life, you know, just like music for me, what it has been for me and done for me through my life, you know, those moments were like when you can't move forward, you know, and then you put on a song and it's just like inspiration to continue to move forward. Maybe like one or two more questions and then take some pictures or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wondering about, I was fortunate enough to see the cover of One Day that was recently put on your Facebook page.
On Facebook,
page.
That guy killed it.
My wife, it's beautiful.
It's amazing.
And so, you know.
I wish I could sing it that good.
It's gorgeous. And so I thought it was amazing testament to the beautiful song that you created. And then I just, maybe you could speak to like, what's that feeling of having somebody honor your work and then extend it into the realm beyond where your influence is. It's got to be something special.
It's really cool. I mean, that song, I mean, when I wrote that song, I wrote it with Bruno Mars before he got a record deal. So it was me and Bruno and his production team, which consisted of him and one other guy and a kid engineer from Teaneck, New Jersey, who got writer's credit on the song somehow. But basically, we were in a room, and I wanted to write a anthemic piece song that would be like the Modest Yahoo calling card. We did it. We wrote it. It was that song. And then it got picked up by NBC for the Winter Olympics 2010. And then I worked it at radio for a year, basically, where I went to every radio station in America when I was off tour, didn't see my kids for like almost the whole year, sat with a radio promoter in a car, you know, different ones, driving in the middle of the country to radio stations that, even though I'd had success at alternative radio, these stations didn't know who I was. Played that song in a cafeteria for people eating pizza while I was playing it, who had no idea that I had I wasn't an artist that was just starting. I was already touring and had been playing it in front of 50,000 people at festivals and had success at radio. But, you know, I was like starting over, and I really worked it hard. And then the radio team, the head of Epic Records at the time, got dropped, and the whole place got like downsized. And so all the radio team that was working that song after all that work was fired, basically. And so the radio never picked it up after all that work. And it was super frustrating because I felt like that was going to be like the thing that was going to get me to the next level. And I put the work in, and then I felt like, you know what, if the song is that song, like it is a hit song. So whether or not radio, you know, does it or not, it's going to be a song that over time is going to resonate and grow. And that's just like exactly what happened, as opposed to a flash in the pan and then it was like boom and over. It's just slowly, slowly over time become like the song that kids sing at camp and people play, you know, for their, you know, it's just, I like see the messages every day and all that kind of stuff. And it's awesome. It's great. It's amazing that that song has done what it's done. And I feel proud. Mm-hmm.
How do you like deal with anti-Semitism, like in reaction to you or your music, or if you have ever experienced that?
Well, I've experienced what, there's a group called the BDS, and I haven't experienced too much like people just like, you know, drawing swastikas on my tour bus or anything like that, you know, but there's a group called the BDS that is anti-Israel, I guess you could say, and they boycott Israeli restaurant owners, artists, speakers. They'll like come with a, like if an Israeli was speaking and it was a place where the BDS was, they would come in the room right now and like try to create issues, so, you know, distractions, and be yelling stuff, holding up signs and stuff. And I had to deal with that really for the first time last summer when I was in a festival in Spain. And the BDS there has like a strong following, and they put a lot of pressure on the festival people to take me off the festival, saying that I didn't support human rights because I support Israel. And therefore, they actually succumbed to the pressure and kicked me off the festival. And then basically what they wanted me to do was write a statement saying that I'm like, you know, against Israel's war crimes, and I don't support the IDF and that kind of thing. And I wouldn't do it. So yeah, they threw me off the festival. And then they put me back on the festival because people wrote in and, you know, made a big fuss about it, and they realized that they were wrong. So they had me come back, and then I performed, but these BDS people were at the show. And they were, you know, had like signs up that said like Nazi Yahoo, and like were throwing things, and were standing in a pyramid, like all giving me the finger with like Palestinian flags. So that was really intense for me to have to deal with. And then I've continued to have to deal with it a little bit. Like, for example, I was releasing a new song called Love Born, which is Love Born from Pain is the real thing, is the lyric in the song. Has like nothing to do with Israel or like the IDF or, you know, any of that, or like politics. It's like a personal thing. And this like cool New York like hip hop website was supposed to premiere it. And we talked for like weeks about them premiering it. And then like the morning of the premiere, they're like, oh, we just have one more question, because I did like a whole interview for them. And they're like, how do you feel about the BDS? And then I responded like a really, what I felt was like thoughtful response. And then they basically were just like, no, we're not gonna premiere the video. And when I said, why not? They said, basically the guy wrote me, you've like taken another racist culture and used it to support the IDF, and we can't support that, you know? So that kind of shit happens to me, you know? Which it doesn't happen that often, but it does happen. It, you know, and it's pretty frustrating. and I consider that to be like anti-Semitism in some regard, in some sense, you know. Yeah.
Sorry, I just have like one more thing, but like, so what do you think, like on a personal level, like what is your best tips, or what have you done to like react to that? Like, have you ever, do you say something, or do you just ignore it?
That's the question. It's like, 'cause you don't want to draw more attention to it. And in some sense, you don't want to, and in another sense, you want to draw attention to it. And I sort of, every time something like that happens, I have to sort of decide, do I want to like make mention of this, or not? And it's a different, I feel like it's a different world for kids growing up now and like going to college, because I know like I get messages from students at college all the time that have like to deal with like Israel Apartheid Week and stuff like that, and I have to deal with these groups that are really anti-Israel. And when I was 18 or 19, I don't know how I would have dealt with that. I would have lost it, you know. So, but I guess one comforting thing is to know that our ancestors dealt with this for 3,000 years in a lot worse ways than, you know, on a college campus. We had to deal with all kinds of anti-Semitism, and it's part of who we are and what's made us stronger. And so you can sort of like be like, well, my great-grandmother was like running from Nazis or pogroms in Russia or kicked out of Spain or whatever it was. So I'm just continuing the tradition. Cool.
All right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks, Manas. And one more thing. Do we have our piece of paper that we wanted? I had an ID for you to read. If you would just read that.
Is it 100.7 or?
100.7, yep.
Okay. This is Modest Yahoo, and you're listening to KXLL at 100.7, public radio with a difference. That was, I didn't forget about your son there. Thanks.